This UCSD TV program is presented by University of California Television. Like what you learn? Visit our website or follow us on Facebook and Twitter to keep up with the latest programs.
So I've taken off my disguise as birthday boy, and I stand before you as moderating a session. And I'm sure you're wondering, why do I presume to moderate a session in this? After all, there is this inherent astrophysicist problem. When I arrived at Scripps, I had the same fear that every Scripps faculty member and university administrator had. What is an astrophysicist doing at an ocean institution? And I too had the same fear, but I was thrown into the maelstrom and had to learn at least a little bit about what each of my every colleague was doing, and then try to explain it to the public and to the funding agencies. And so I learned quite a bit in a short period of time. My colleagues cooked up tutorial classes for me, and it was all okay. So, you've probably heard about everything about my career, except what has happened since I stepped down as director. And that actually was in September of 06, and that was traumatic. And it was traumatic for an interesting reason. I, by that time, was used to having an interesting person in my office every hour of the day, talking about good science. They had to. And then suddenly, it all stopped. And I had thought I was smart, but nobody wanted to talk to me anymore. I was getting bored, and I also discovered that I couldn't sustain a consecutive thought for more than about 10 minutes. And this was a serious problem. And into this slough of despair, there stepped an opportunity which I seized. The Christ College at Cambridge invited me to become their C.P. Snow lecturer for the winter term, and it started a relationship that I've continued since more and more regularly as time has passed, for at least a quarter. Now, C.P. Snow was a great example for me because he did both science and policy and was noted for that and his understanding of the division between science and the humanities. So in the peace afforded me by the C.P. Snow lectureship period, I began to think, well, what should I do? And the answer was, do what you did as director. And listen to all the people around you on important issues and try to interpret them for the policy world. But this time I felt I had to cure the astrophysicist problem again and actually know more about what I was talking about than I had. I'd been winging it, and I am sure that many of my colleagues were distressed when they heard me speaking in loose terms to important people. So that this re-education process took about 3 years before I felt ready even to know enough to presume to start making contributions to the field. But one thing I knew was that you pick your right colleagues to work with. And so my coming out party was a paper that that David Victor and Ramanathan and I put together. And it actually sets in some ways, it connects up with what you just heard, and it also sets up the rest of this session. What this paper was addressing was the fact that it looked like it would be very difficult for our global society to achieve the goals of limiting climate warming to 2 degrees centigrade. And that even if you reviewed all that was happening and you undertook all the steps that you could to reduce the rate of slowing, it would be very difficult to avoid the 2-degree threshold. That is then the primary, and what we looked at was not only extrapolation of trends, but we tried to estimate what things could we do if we were determined to do that to slow the rate of climate change. And the most important thing that we could do was to look at the in addition that would offset the carbon warming that's in store for us, was to look at the other non-CO2 greenhouse gases that Ray just talked about and that Ramanathan had also worked on. And this was an advantage because they all had short lifetimes, and if you managed to actually stop those emissions, the impact on the climate would be almost within a few years. You'd measure progress, and that would be an incentive. Whereas with carbon, if we all stop breathing and stop emitting carbon, it'll still be 50 years before there's an impact on the climate. And this idea had legs, and it led to one of the few treaties that the United States is engaged in, the Climate and Clear Air Coalition, which the State Department announced in 2012. And the paper that we wrote, the version of it that we wrote for Foreign Affairs, was in President Obama's briefing book for a G8 meeting in which he tried to bring the G8 countries into the coalition, which he successfully did. So that was a pretty good debut, I thought. But the important thing was that even if we did all of that, we were in for major climate change, and that it would be much more rapid than we had, any of us had expected. IPCC AR5 does agree with us, and they argue that, based in this measurement of temperature, that the rate of climate change will double in the next 20 years. So that then sets up the session. Our first speaker is going to be Peter Wadhams, who's a great expert on the polar climate. The polar climate is the cockpit of climate change for much of North America and Europe. I was an inspired guess by Milankovic, the astronomer, years ago, that a 0.7% change in the amount of sunlight that we get from little orbital variations made a big difference to the Arctic, and that triggered the ice ages. And since then, we've realized that the Arctic played a significant role in the reaction of the Earth to climate change for external forcing. So Peter's going to talk about the fastest changing area of the Earth, the Arctic, and I know he will also can't resist thinking about what impacts that will have on the rest of us in the lower 48. Then our second speaker will be Dan Kahan, and here I think it's worth saying that no state has done a better job of assessing the impacts of climate change than California. It's possibly rational to say that no country has done better than California. And within that state, no institution has made a bigger contribution to assessing the impacts of climate change than Scripps. And within Scripps, no one has had a bigger impact on that assessment process than Dan Kahan. And so you're going to hear from him. And then if there's any time left over, I will continue this debate about the hiatus and then argue that all our work on 2 degrees was meaningless. And, but you'll see why. That is not a rational goal to set for climate negotiations. So with that, Peter, you're on.
Thanks, Charlie. And happy birthday, and many thanks for inviting me here. How do I make this go? Ah, it goes. Okay. Well, for about a couple of words about myself. I'm an observational sea ice physicist, which is a very small profession to be in. In fact, I think for most of my career, I was the only one in Britain. And we were a very lonely group because oceanographers thought we were glaciologists and glaciologists thought we were oceanographers. I was at the Scott Polar Research Institute where I became director. That was an institute that was established in memory of Captain Scott. And then the institute lost its sort of autonomy within Cambridge University. So I decided to move to DAMTP, Department of Applied Maths and Theoretical Physics, where I now am. So, first of all, then and now in the Arctic, John Orcott showed some graphical material on this yesterday. So I'm just going to update it by a couple of years and show what further things have happened since 2012. But this is 1970, and I took this picture of the Canadian ship Hudson heading north through Bering Strait in August of 1970, going on for a northwest passage transit. And you can see that it's getting on for evening, and the water, if you look at the water, it's just beginning to freeze. So the water was very cold and a small amount of freezing was going on, which would probably melt the next morning. But 3 weeks ago, I sailed the same route on the Healy, the US Coast Guard icebreaker, and we experienced surface water temperatures of 15 degrees just south of Bering Strait and 10 degrees north of Bering Strait. So a massive change in surface water temperatures has occurred in the Chukchi Sea, Bering and Chukchi Seas. Then, a few days later, the Hudson came into these conditions just off Point Barrow, and these are great, big, hefty, multi-year ice flows, 2.5 to 3 metres thick. A lot of effort to get through the stuff and get into the Northwest Passage. And this is last week on the Healy, and I had to work hard to find a picture that had some ice in it, because as John showed yesterday, if you go to the Arctic these days in August, you see vast expanses of open water. But if you look at some ice, you can see how rotten it is. It was melting all around us, and we could see if we stopped just for a day, you'd find the whole landscape changing during that day, because most of the ice that was around you would melt. So really the ice is very rapidly retreating, and it will do so for another month. And this hazy thing is a wave buoy. One of the mechanisms for this rapid retreat that ONR has considered is the impact of the newly established wave field in the Beaufort Sea in summer. You now have a big fetch from waves, wave action breaking up ice. And so we have an array of 30 wave ice buoys out at the moment, measuring wave energy passing through and into the ice. And this was one of them, which we thought we'd revisit. We'd established it on a very heavy 500 meter diameter flow in the spring, and you can see it's only just about in ice now, and probably by now it's out in water, and this ice was only about 40 centimeters thick. So that's the then and now, and you can see that the contrast between conditions in the Arctic as they were when I started my career in this field, which is 45 years ago, man and boy, but most not boy, and now very huge changes. Charlie showed this picture like this yesterday, which was the temperature, global temperature changes since the late 19th century when anthropogenic global warming started. And the pattern, you can see it's the same shape as Charlie's graph, but the scales are different because this is only stations north of 60. And you can see that the pattern of warming has been the same in the Arctic as in other parts of the world, but the magnitude has been much greater. There's been about a 3-degree warming in this from these stations instead of 0.8 of a degree, which is what we've had in the planet as a whole. So there's an Arctic amplification been going on, and this is what's helped to drive the extreme warming and large changes in the Arctic relative to the rest of the world. And I won't explain why we think why that amplification has happened, mainly because we're not absolutely sure, but I'll move on for lack of time, but it's there, and it's a big driver to in Arctic change. As a result of these rapidly rising air temperatures, sea ice has been retreating, especially in summer, And really, the summer retreat was first detected in 1950. And that's the bottom of the graph there. The winter effect was harder to detect because the Arctic is a landlocked ocean, and in the winter the ice is there right up to the coast of the Arctic no matter what. But the summer, it unglues itself from the surrounding land masses and retreats into the centre of the Arctic basin. And that's been going on since 1950, and in a roughly linear way. The pink line here shows the average summer, that's September, is mid-September is the height of summer in the Arctic. Mid-September ice age in the 1980s, and in 2005, the retreat really first became so obvious that it looked that people started to notice. That's the bottom right hand. And the bottom and the left hand one shows that in 2007, there was another huge chunk taken out of the Arctic, like somebody's taken a bite out of the Arctic ice, giving you a real genuine blue sea or ocean almost over the Beaufort and Chukchi seas. So this was when people really started to take notice. And 2012, there was another big jump downwards in area to 3.4 million square kilometres from 4.2 was the previous record. And this shows the 2012. And in 2012, it could have gone a lot further because this is a map from the University of Bremen drawn from a different satellite on the same day, mid-September, and the green and yellow here shows low concentrations of ice. So the ice edge shown by the NSIDC maps concealed a lot of open water further north still. So the actual area of sort of solid ice was quite a lot less. So there has been a partial recovery in the last couple of years, but we think, I think it's a wiggle on the way downwards. And one of the things that's changed is this very solid ice I showed at the beginning, multi-year ice, is now vanishing from the Arctic. Nearly the pattern of ice drift has changed. The ice tends to drift out of the Arctic within a year of formation. And the red here, which shows multi-year ice, has become... multi-ice has gone from being dominant in the Arctic to being a threatened and endangered species. And this was last summer. The only multi-year ice that remained is this red stuff, which was a very thin band around the north coast of Ellesmere Island and Greenland. And that's the only place you'll find much multi-year ice today. This is the famous map showing the area of Arctic ice. I left off the last couple of years, compared to the IPCC models. That's the model data, the model set on the top right are all the models used in the IPCC assessments. And you can see that they're all drastically wrong. The black line there is the median of all the model predictions for September ice extent to the end of this century, showing the ice still hanging around. But the red is the reality, which got detached from models around in the 1970s. And I think there's nowhere in geophysics is there a bigger disconnect between model predictions and reality. So I just want to make a little quote here from Charlie that was quoted yesterday from Charlie's book on convection and substorm, saying, "Models still cannot deal with the small time and space scales that are central to our observational experience." This is on a different topic, of course, but I think it's absolutely true of geophysical models today dealing with Arctic ice. There's processes that they don't deal with, and especially they're small-scale processes, which we really need to incorporate, because at the moment, nature is about two standard deviations away from the consensus view of models. Well, that was area. And what makes the story worse is that the area conceals the fact that the ice within that area is getting thinner. And for the last 40 years or so, I've been measuring ice thickness from submarine voyages in the Arctic with the British Navy. I've done six voyages of that kind, and the sixth one, this was the last one when the submarine blew up, so I stopped doing it then. And what we would do is put an upward-looking echo sounder, or in this case a multi-beam sounder, on the submarine. The multi-beam has the advantage it produces really beautiful pictures, of 3D pictures of the underside, so you can see the structure of the ice bottom, pressure ridges, multi-year ice, first-year ice. The first thing we found after several voyages was that the ice was getting thinner, and I think I did the probably, I think it was the first paper on thinning of sea ice in the Arctic in Nature in 1990. And we compared two sets of previous voyages separated by a decade where the submarine did a grid in the sort of British submarine stomping ground between Spitsbergen and Greenland and the Pole. And we found a 15% decrease in thickness. And then extending that, and you can see how the contours go from 5, 6, 7 meters down to 4 meters. And then the top right shows today, or actually 10 years ago, is down to 2 to 3 meters in that area. A really radical loss of thickness. And that loss of thickness now is at least 50%. The average thickness of ice year-round in the Arctic is 50% less than it was 30 years ago. That's a big loss. So when you apply the loss and look at volumes of ice, that is thickness multiplied by area, you get a loss which is more than linear. And this is work that's now being done by PIOMAS. That's a project at the University of Washington, which takes area measurements from satellites, thickness measurements from sonar, combines the two, and that includes a lot of US sonar measurements as well as British. And so it's now a more than linear decrease in volume. And if you look at the monthly volumes from over the last 30 years, you get these set of graphs. And the bottom one, the black one, is September. And you can scarcely resist the temptation to extrapolate. And of course, the word extrapolate, when you use that at Dampt, it's the rudest, rude, obscene word you can possibly use. It's an nine-letter word, but it's like a four-letter word. Because to mathematicians, you mustn't do this, but to physicists, why not? And if you take the you take this September curve and you go down, and by 2015. It goes to zero, and that's next year. So according to this, there's no reason, because there's no process that's countervailing. There's nothing coming in that the cavalry isn't galloping to the rescue of the sea ice. Everything is pushing it to go more rapidly away because all the feedback's acting that direction. So I still think it's going to disappear in 2015, and it's disappearing quite a lot this year. There's an El Nino coming in and raising, certain to raise air temperatures during the coming year. So I still would make a tentative prediction anyway that we'll be down to a very small area of sea ice in September of next year. This was expressed graphically by PIOMAS by putting it on a clock curve. And they called this the Arctic Death Spiral. That was Mark Serres chose this modest title, which has achieved a certain public currency. But it's showing these monthly volumes going around the clock from the 70s. And you can see how once you get to the middle of the curve of the graph, you've had it, and September is getting pretty close to the middle. And the other months are following along. So the 1 month ice-free period in September that we might get next year will quite rapidly expand into about 4 months. So there'll be the Arctic will become a seasonal ice cover like the Antarctic is now, with an ice-free summer and ice covered the rest of the year.
What are the elevars?
Oh, huge, gigantic. So that was the introduction. I'll use my time up. But I wanted to say, what are the feedbacks? What are the impacts of this? And I'm going to deal with four. The reduction in global albedo, Retreat of the snow line, the melting of the Greenland ice sheet, which leads to sea level rise, and the biggest threat of all, which I think is methane emission from Arctic seabed. This is a paper that was originated here at Scripps and this year, and it was estimating from the retreat what that means as far as global albedo is concerned. And the authors concluded that over the Arctic, averaged over a year, there's a 4% decrease in albedo been going on, which is equivalent to a 6.4 watt per square meter increase in radiative forcing. And that's the same when you take it over the whole planet, that's the same as adding a quarter to the greenhouse gas forcing to the planet. So this is a feedback, but the feedback's already beginning to drive the original forcing. And I think they underestimated, because I think they should have included the snow line feedback as well. And if they include that, you're doubling this, because the snow line, the area occupied by Northern Hemisphere snow, has also gone down very radically in the regions of land around the Arctic Ocean, which are affected by the newly ice-free Arctic Ocean, which has warmer wind, more air masses moving over it. And that's given us a 6 million square kilometre negative anomaly in snow area in June, which is the time of maximum solar insolation. So the negative terrestrial snow line anomaly, which also gives you a big albedo drop from snow to tundra or snow-free surface, that's the albedo drop is the same for snow versus no snow as it is from sea ice versus water. And that's greater than the sea ice retreat. So the snow line anomaly plus the sea ice retreat is probably at least adding at least half to the warming effect of CO2. So already we're seeing just the Arctic, not any other part of the world, is these two feedbacks, the albedo feedback due to sea ice, the albedo feedback due to snow, are adding a half to the rate of heating of the Earth due to carbon dioxide addition. Greenland used to never get any melt on the Greenland ice cap until the 1980s. Then you started to get melt around the edges. That's the left-hand picture. In 2012, for the first time, there was melt in the summer over the entire surface of the Greenland ice sheet. That meltwater goes down into the interior of the ice sheet through moulins, which are holes in the ice sheet, and helps to drive. Not only does it reduce the mass of the Greenland ice sheet, and which you can measure now from the GRACE satellite gravity mission, and as is coming out to be about 300 cubic kilometres a year, which makes it greater than the loss due to all other ice sheets combined on the planet, and greater than the addition due to warming of the ocean. So that if we look at sea level rise, we used to have two factors. One was warming of the ocean. The other was losses from subpolar glaciers, Alps, Alaska, and so on. Now we have three factors, and the third one is the biggest, which is loss from the Greenland ice sheet. So the predictions of sea level rise over the next century, which were very conservative in the case of the 2007 IPCC, only 30 centimetres or so, were increased in the 2013, but most glaciologists believe that the increasing rate of loss from the Greenland ice sheet and the beginning of observed loss from the Antarctic ice sheet will give us at least a metre, and possibly quite a lot more than a metre, during the coming century, with all the implications that has for increased rates of loss, or increased rates of storm surges, which particularly threatening low-lying areas where a lot of poor people live, like Bangladesh. So it's always the poor people that have to pay the price of global change. But worst of all, perhaps, is the threat from offshore Arctic methane. The interesting about the Arctic is that it's an ocean which is one-third of the area is continental shelf, and that's very shallow shelf, 50 to 100 metres deep. All those light blue bits are 50 to 100 metres deep. And that's the area which the September sea ice has retreated from. So it sits in the middle of the deep part of the Arctic Ocean. It's gone from the shelves. And as soon as it goes from the shelves warm up, the water warms up, because it's only a single layer structure absorbing a lot of solar radiation. We were seeing 10 degrees in the Chukchi Sea. These are some earlier measurements, 2007, showing 5 degrees, but it's still degrees, many degrees above zero, and it never used to be above zero at all in summer because the sea ice was still there and acting as an air conditioning system, holding the water temperature to zero, because if it tried to warm up, it would just melt more ice. Once the ice has gone, it can warm up as much as it likes. And that's that warmer water reaches the seabed because of wind-induced overturning and warms the seabed. Now, the seabed has got offshore permafrost in it, on it, which used to be, which dates from the last ice age. It's a relic. And that permafrost holds down a lot of methane hydrates. And a group from the University of Alaska and the Russian Pacific Oceanographic Institute has been working every year in that area, every summer, finding more and more methane emissions going on from the seabed. And this is a sonar image from last year, showing methane plumes coming up. This is some pictures taken from an ROV showing methane bubbles up against the bottom of sea ice. And here's a methane plume which the ROV was swimming through. So these are methane bubbles. The group that's doing that work estimated that there's 700 gigatons of methane sitting in those sediments in the form of methane hydrates, which turn back into methane and are released and reach the surface of the ocean because it's only 70 meters deep. So they haven't got time to dissolve en route. And they estimated of that 700, perhaps 50 gigatons would be released in the next few years at the rate of increase that's going on at the moment. So some colleagues and I in Cambridge wrote a paper last year for Nature in which we used an economic model, which was the model used by the Stern Review, which was a British government review of climate change, which used an economic integrated assessment model, and what would be the cost to the planet of a methane outbreak like this, and we came up with $50 trillion. So that kind of puts all the gains of global warming, like navigating the Northwest Passage, looking for oil and so on, it puts them into the shade because the cost is huge. And also we estimated the gain, the how much warming would happen, and methane is a very powerful greenhouse gas, although it's short-lived, only perhaps 7 years, and we were getting 0.6 of a degree, rather, warming in the next 10 years. That's a very big boost to global warming. It more than doubles the rate. And so that would be very nasty. This has led me to just make this final... This was a slide of all the things you maybe can do, but I'm going to sort of... I'm sure Charlie's going to talk about this, but I'll just... This is my personal creed, which is that it's too late for lots of things. That if we want to stop this happening and stop the sort of especially the accelerated global warming, which seems to be happening because of these processes that aren't at present being taken account of enough by IPCC, then I don't think it's enough just to reduce carbon emissions because of the residence time of carbon dioxide in the energy system, which is at least 100 years, maybe 1,000 years. There's a ratchet effect. You pull this fossil fuel out of the ground, burn it, you're warming the climate. That carbon stays in the energy system for a long time before it eventually gets incorporated in a foram and sinks to the seabed. So what we've done, we're going to have to live with, even if we stop doing it. So that's the first lesson. Second lesson is, well, can we hide it by geoengineering techniques that would could in fact hold the warming if you keep applying them, but they don't stop things like acidification of the oceans because they don't stop the carbon dioxide increase. So that's not really a long-term solution. So the only solution I'm saying is here, remove CO2 from the atmosphere. And there are no well-known, no easy methods, no methods that are less than impossibly expensive at the moment. But my last slide, I appeal to the wonderful ingenuity of the Americans, because I know that Americans, like Europeans, are reluctant to reduce their carbon dioxide emissions because they have to change the way they live. And it's a sort of guilt trip, and people don't like being driven on a guilt trip. But here's a challenge. Forget all this. Well, don't forget it, reducing carbon dioxide. But go for a massive research effort to find a way to take carbon out of the atmosphere. So this is a challenge to American ingenuity. Well, so this, I'll leave you with that challenge.
In the previous presentation, I was actually surprised to see that there was a more CO2 absorption after we got rid of the forests than before. And then I see in your slide is deforestation. So is it reforestation? It may be the fact that you want, I presume that was agriculture with all its plants that did the absorption. Well, can agriculture, massive agriculture with different plants, help out as a attractive ingenuity?
Well, it could. The idea of afforestation is to plant trees everywhere, but you mustn't burn them. You've got when they die, you've got to go cut the wood down and bury it somewhere forever, or use it to build houses. You must stop. The world should stop building houses out of concrete, because concrete's made from cement, and cement's incredibly wasteful of CO2 because of the chemical. There's a chemical release of CO2 as well as the energy. So stop building concrete houses. Build houses out of wood, like this beautiful building here, and make sure the house doesn't burn down. That would help, but it would be. It's a small factor. And what I'm saying here, all these nice things we should do are small things. So we need a technical thing where you can have a big pipe, pump in air at one end, take the CO2 out.
I think we'll take one more question, then we'll move on to Dan, and then we'll have questions.
Okay.
I was really happy to see you mention methane release from the Arctic, because I think that's a huge thing people are paying attention to.
Yes.
And I wondered whether you had also worked to quantify the potential methane release from the margins. I've seen a paper, the shift in the Gulf Stream, for example, is supposed to have exposed gas hydrates to much warmer conditions, which dissociate them. And I saw just off North Carolina, 2.5 gigatons they've estimated to be released in one little place. So has the changes in circulation and the effects on methane release the deeper ocean or the continental margins been quantified yet?
It's being worked on actively at the moment. I should have mentioned the other methane sources that are sort of frightening, that even if this outburst doesn't happen from the seabed, the thawing of permafrost on land will in the end produce even more methane than this, but over a longer period, because it takes the permafrost on land longer to melt, to thaw, and it produces methane and CO2. But offshore, it's released from continental margins and deeper parts of the ocean, and it's even been proposed that should be an industrial source of methane. But the difference there is that it dissolves in water, and so on the way up, it mostly, if it's more than 200 or 300 meters deep, it will dissolve, and it doesn't reach the atmosphere. So it changes. You get the carbon dissolved in the ocean, and that has a small effect on the ocean, but it doesn't have its big effect on the atmosphere, whereas the Arctic it does, because the water depth is too shallow for the methane to dissolve en route.
Happy birthday, Charlie, and it's an honor to be here. Charlie mentioned the assessments that have been taking place in California. Actually, it's interesting. I would say one of the remarkable developments in climate science is the real advent of regional studies. It's increasingly recognized that in order to really come to grips with and make decisions based upon climate information, we need more than global and larger scale studies. We actually need to understand our regional environments. And of course, California has been a central figure in that. And beginning in summer of 2005, when Governor Schwarzenegger announced some pretty ambitious emission targets, he also set in motion a set of state climate assessments, which ostensibly would be done every 2 years. Well, we're now embarking on the fourth of those assessments. So you can see that it's slipped a little bit, but it's ongoing. So I'm going to talk about I'm not going to try to cover all of that, because it's just one knows not where to start or stop. But what I wanted to talk about actually is a little bit of a California view of the snow ice theme that Peter just mentioned, and I suspect that Jeff talked about yesterday to some extent. And the idea here is to use the spring snowpack, which is harbored in mountainous regions in the state, as an index of climate change and really an index of what we are confronted with as time goes forward here. So this is a picture that my colleague Mike Dettinger put together. Mike is a USGS scientist that works here at Scripps. He's sitting in the back row there. And what he did was he took stock of the precipitation climate across the United States, and he stratified these by the temperature at which precipitation occurs. And the warm shading on this figure actually depicts areas where a lot of the precipitation in a particular year occurs in the temperature environment between freezing and not too far below freezing, so 3 Celsius below. And the idea here is that this area of the West, which shows up as green and even red, the red areas being the west slope of the Sierras and the Cascades, are areas in which there's a particular vulnerability to warming. That is, we lose snow in favor of rain. And snow is an important ingredient in our water supply here in the West because we are challenged by way of artificial reservoirs. It's really difficult, especially these days, to build a reservoir. There's a lot of environmental impacts. A lot of the prime sites have already been developed and so forth. And the other thing about snow to rain is that it becomes more of a hazard if we get precipitation as rain instead of snow. So we have a lot of runoff to contend with in a short amount of time. And consequently, this fingerprint of the sensitivity to warming is really kind of a unique part of our climate that some of the United States doesn't face. We're going to be just, this is kind of an excuse for me to say that we're using a hydrological modeling framework in order to take stock of water and in particular snow over the landscape. We're doing this from downscaled climate simulations. The downscaling in this case happens to be at just above 10 kilometers or so on a pixel. A typical GCM, global climate model, is more like 150 kilometers nowadays. So we have to find ways to translate that to a scale that's more commensurate with our landscape here in the West. And I'm going to be focusing on the color shaded areas here, which is probably less than 10% of the state of California. It's the mountainous region where, of course, in the cool season, winter season, it's cool enough that we get snow. And there's, even though this is a relatively small area, it accounts for a disproportionate amount of the delivery of water in in the state, and snow itself is an extra reservoir that supplements what we have in the built reservoir system in the state. So when we're looking to the future, of course, it's not news that the climate is warming. That's quite certain. Drier or wetter, though, is less decided. Climate models are to some extent undecided in most of the water-bearing areas in California as to the way that will go. But in consensus, the answer really is that probably it's not going to change too much from what we've seen historically. But the other thing that's not going to change too much is the fact that there's going to be a lot of volatility. California, when you stack us up in relative sense against the rest of the United States, is the most volatile precipitation climate in the nation. And we're seeing, of course, the effects of that this year, where we have exquisitely low water supplies after 2-3 years of real dry conditions. The result of this, of course, is the fact that it's warming means that we're going to lose a share of our present-day spring snowpack, and, of course, that has consequences, as I mentioned. This is a set of global climate models downscaled to Northern California, and each of these dots, I guess, yeah, okay. Each of these dots is a solution for one particular model. We have 32 of them that are arrayed here. And this actually happens to be a generation ago as far as the global climate model enterprise, but the message is largely retained in the latest family of models. And what you can see is relative to today's normals, climate warms to the point at which it, at least in consensus with these particular simulations, reaches this 2 degrees Celsius number that Charlie mentioned earlier by about 2070. So, of course, depending on scenario and depending on model and so forth, you could vary quite a bit from that. But that's probably a pretty good rule of thumb as to what's confronting us in the future as far as temperature. And actually, there's two kinds of scenarios here, a blue scenario, which is more optimistic, and a red scenario, which is less optimistic. And they begin to diverge about mid-century, the higher emission scenarios becoming much warmer than the lower emission scenarios by the end of the century. And that's another story. Well, this is, in a sense, an error bar from I've shown you the 90th and or the 10th and 90th percentile. So, you know, that's kind of a measure. And of course, that's a long conversation. But as far as precipitation, so here we are today, and this is the median, again, of these 32 simulations. You can see that by and large, there's not that much change. This is the 2070 mark here in red. And on the other hand, if you look at the snowpack in this large block area of the Sierra Nevada, you can see a pretty profound change as time goes on, and I've blown that up here. So this is 2070. Each one of these is a particular winter simulation, and we're looking at the April 1st snow measure, which is this is a snow water equivalent aggregated over this entire domain. And April 1st today is about the zenith of the California snow accumulation. Beyond that time, it starts to melt off. So what we see is that there's a a progressive loss in the water harbored in the snowpack. Doesn't mean that we've lost water in the state. It just means that essentially it's less manageable. And by 2050, we've lost about a third of it in consensus. And by 2070, that's that 2 degrees Celsius mark, we've, by my estimate, we lost about half of today's snowpack. So this is a way of kind of visualizing this. So what I've done here is I've arrayed each April's snowpack with a dot, and I've arrayed it by the temperature and precipitation that actually occurred on a particular year. So each dot is a year, and we're looking at how those play out. This happens to be the climatological period, so this is 1961 through 1990. Fast forwarding to the first 30 years of the 21st century, this is what happens. And by the way, the color scale here is representing the amount of snow that is contained in the California snowpack. And furthermore, the dot size I've made inversely proportional to the amount of snowpack. So you can see the low snow years by the larger orange dots. And as we go forward into the 21st century, this is sort of a mid-century slice and end of century slice, you can see that increasingly we have years in which there's very low snow contained in this mountain environment. And it doesn't mean that there aren't years with a lot of snow. There are a few of them, but they occur more and more rarely as time goes on. And you can look at the, you know, using the sample, the odds of achieving, in this case, median snow, which over the historical period is 50-50 odds. But as we go forward in time, the odds become slimmer and slimmer, so that by 2070, that's 2 degrees Celsius world, the odds of achieving median snow are probably only about 15%. On the other hand, if you look at the odds of having years which are 10th percentile or less in today's climate, that grows and grows. And by the 2 degrees Celsius mark, we're having that maybe 3 years out of 10 instead of 1 year out of 10. So we're really seeing a hydrological climate that's not informed by our experience, and that's what we are looking towards. So I want to wrap up here, and I know time is dear, and we need to get Charlie on the podium here. But as Charlie in Charlie's era at Scripps, we started a set of these state climate assessments. Charlie has argued and made the case very strongly that we need continued and sustained assessments. Those, of course, are underpinned by observations, which are a hallmark of this institution's diagnostic studies and process-oriented studies and models, in order to see our way forward into the future. The assessments that are ongoing have increasingly become broader as well as deeper. They're now starting to engage not only scientists but decision makers, which is a really important ingredient to make them effective. And again, there's a set of vulnerabilities in this state. The snowpack is only one of them. But as we go forward, of course, there's going to be a lot of attention paid not only to the slowly evolving features, but also to the extreme events that live amongst them. So anyway, thank you and happy birthday, Charlie.
So if you'll forgive me, Dan, I think I'll just move on. I'd just like to comment that in 2006, I believe, California passed Assembly Bill 32, which commits the state to reducing its greenhouse gas emissions in consonance, roughly, with the requirements of the Kyoto Protocol. And the very first statement in the whereas as to why California is doing this, whereas we expect to lose 90% of the snow water equivalent of the Sierra Nevada by the end of the century, and that is the result of the first California climate adaptation assessment, which is proof that when you talk about adaptation, you talk about the things that people care about, and rather than inhibiting mitigation actions, it promotes them. Often the debate had been, if you tell people they can adapt, they won't do anything to mitigate. But in fact, when you tell people what's at stake, they may do something to mitigate. So I'm going to get started here if I can. Let's see. Can we move on? So I'm going to go a little bit more briefly because it turns out that this hiatus business has been a theme, and I've got a few things to add to it. And then my colleague and co-author, David Victor, will continue this discussion later. So I'm just going to raise a few questions. If the globe hasn't been warming in surface temperature, why are we experiencing so much climate change? In fact, there's a kind of triple paradox here. Well, here's a graph that was taken from the Daily Mail in 2013, and it makes the point that the global temperature in 1997 and 2012, there were variations in the intervening area, but for 16 years the temperature remained roughly constant as measured by the global temperature. So the first paradox is, why was it constant when the CO2 concentrations were increasing? Since 1998, when this hiatus started, we've added 28% to our greenhouse gas burden. That's about 4.4 watts per square meter. But it appears that the temperature, as this measure, hasn't measured the hazard of climate change, because during this period and for the first time, the climate community was able to document that there's been an increase in extreme events, particularly clearly in data about heat waves. And then, as you have heard from Peter, why is the Arctic warming so rapidly when the global temperatures remain constant? So you've got three paradoxical issues tied together. And any physicist likes to think that paradoxes that occur simultaneously are the same paradox. And so we're going to try to take that point of view and see if we can sustain it. Now, if you take a longer perspective, that here is a long-term trend of the global temperature since the industrial era, and the hiatus is blue arrow over there, and it started with the 1998 El Nino, which was the largest on record in the 20th century. It raised the global temperature, and then basically it stayed high for the last 16 years. And so we are experiencing a sustained period of exceptional warmth for the century, but it hasn't increased while CO2 did. So now, the global temperature is dominated by measurements of sea surface temperature, 70% of the area of the globe. So skipping over all the other attempts that people made to explain it, we finally end up with the ocean, as since dominates the calculation of the ocean of the global temperature, we should look there first. And many people did, but not everybody. So let's just start with something that's terribly important, dominates the historical climate of California, certainly back for 4,000 or 5,000 years, and this is the El Niño-La Niña cycle. And this is a plot of the Pacific Ocean sea surface temperature on the left during a warm El Niño phase, and on the right, a La Niña phase. The complete opposite there, the Odette and Odile of climate science. And you can see that it's not so hard to get a 2-degree difference in sea surface temperature in the Pacific, which is something like 48% of the Earth's area. So whatever happens in the Pacific makes a difference to the calculation of the global temperature. So I want to tell you a little bit about how this event works in overly simplified terms, of course. But here's a cross-section of the Pacific Ocean looking, let's say, from the slightly below the equator northward, and you've got Darwin on the left and Lima, Peru on the right, and you've got a sketch of the ocean density and temperature. And this is the La Nina phase, which is the one that we've been in for the last 16 years. Usually we alternate back and forth. There have been some slight variations, but basically the idea is that you've got cold water coming up on the east there next to Peru. It comes to the surface. The trade winds often blow towards the west, as they do here, and they push the water westward, get heated by the sun as you go, and finally it can't go any place when it gets to the warm water pool off the coast of Indonesia, and so it is finally brought beneath the surface and is subducted into the ocean, where it's unavailable to warm the atmosphere. Now, the other thing this little diagram shows is actually you push the water uphill. It expands as it warmed. And so if for some reason the trade winds should fail, then this water, hot water that's been pushed uphill, will suddenly be released and flow back down towards the coast of South America, and it will be warmed a second time, and suddenly the whole eastern Pacific will be flooded with hot water. That is the El Nino phase. There is also a major reorganization of the jet streams. So the question is, what's been happening in the last 16 years? And just about 6 months ago, a major paper came out from Matthew England and numerous collaborators that gave us an estimate of the wind stress, the west-east wind stress, that goes back to about the turn of the century. And what you'll notice is that it's oscillated back and forth between El Nino phases, which is above the line, and La Nina phase below the line, except that beginning around 2000, sort of after that El Nino was over with, you see the wind stress suddenly drops down, and it drops to in the La Nina direction. So the wind stress is now twice or more what it had been during this historical period in which it's sampled. So the trade winds have been exceptionally strong and are in the La Nina sense. So do you see the water going underneath? Let's see. Yes, so then here's another paper that also came out within the last few months. And this is a famous paper on the ocean heat content, which is a global measure of the heat content measured by the Argo project, separated into tranches. The upper ocean is in the black, and the El Nino is located there. And the upper ocean, as you can see, the heat content between 0 and 300 meters depth didn't change very much. And that's the heat that affects the atmosphere in the short term, and that is the sea surface temperature. But at depth, the heat content has increased dramatically during the hiatus when the global temperature was constant, as so measured. This diagram is constant with that. And the whole argument now, a very interesting argument going on in the community, is where is that, this is a global issue, where is that hot water going? And from our experience and things that you've seen from Lynn Talley and others, there are only a few places where surface water goes underwater. One is in the North Atlantic, one is at the Antarctic, and the third are at the western extremities of the oceans where the El Nino process forms them, forces water underwater. So here's a diagram that just came out a week ago that shows new measurements, particularly in the Atlantic, of where deep water is forming there and taking heat underground, underwater. And you can see it in the North Atlantic, but you can also see a band from the Atlantic, the analog of the El Nino. So we're pretty certain then that the climate has been absorbing a great deal of energy, even though this measure of climate warming is not a good one. It's a popular one. It's easy for everybody to understand, but it is not a measure of success or failure in your efforts to deal with the climate. The other thing that's worth saying on at this time is there's been a major reduction in Arctic sea ice area, and the rate of reduction of sea ice area accelerated around the time of the beginning of the hiatus. And you can see this in a different way. Here's the September data of sea ice area measured in percent. And you can see that when the hiatus started, there's been a progressive decline in sea ice area that was more variable in the past. And the sea ice area now has declined by about 40% over the average since 1979, when satellite measurements started. And so this sea ice area has a significant impact, secondary impact, as Peter pointed out, on the warming rate in the Arctic. And so here are the numbers again that Peter talked about. But the interesting thing about the empirical estimate of the albedo effect taken from noticing the changes in the Ceres atmospheric emission rate and correlating it with the sea ice area. The interesting thing is it's larger than was assumed in earlier models. And so that may be a reason why Peter's ice models are diverging, ice observations are diverging from the models. In any case, the question that we're interested in now but don't know the answer: did the Arctic warming associated with the 98 trigger a continuing ice retreat when the winter regrowth could not make up for the previous year's loss? It was a triggered effect, maybe. And this is consistent with the reduction in percentage of a reduction of multi-year ice. Now, we also have a new warming source in the Arctic that may be stronger than we thought. So is it altering the north-south heat flow? Did that, in fact, strengthen the trade winds, create the La Nina bias, and thus enable the persistent ocean sequestration? And if all of this pulls together, you've got a sort of metastable dynamical quasi-equilibrium. And the question is, how long can it last? And if it is actually affected by the super Arctic warming, will it only stop when the sea ice retreats and completely? And that gives us, along with Peter's estimate, not very much time for this particular metastable state to last. Then finally, and this is what David will talk about, this is a paper, are the diplomats aiming for the right goal? Is the 2-degree goal well designed? For the last 16 years, it's been a very poor indicator of the stresses that we're placing on the climate system. And he will argue that you should have as things that you measure, things that governments can act on. So then I think then the final aspect of it is that the hiatus in global temperature growth has been the most decisive argument at the political level against action on the climate change. And it stops action in its tracks because what people are saying is that the climate science community must be suffering from mass delusion. They keep talking about global warming, but in fact the temperature's been constant for 16 years. It's a mass delusion of our own making. What are you guys talking about? And that argument has stopped political action. And so the real issue then is, are we aiming for the right goals? Shouldn't we be measuring as an index of progress ocean heat content? Are we ready to do that on a regular basis as an indicator? And there's a related measurement of top of atmosphere radiation balance with the same quality. But shouldn't we be using indicators for progress against climate change that are fundamental to the system? So that's So I took more time than everybody else. I took us over by 5 minutes.
Questions?
Do you want to dare? I've got Ram over here. Ram is a co-author on the key paper behind this argument. So if I could take that question.
Charlie, just a couple of comments. On the hiatus, there's nothing new. This has happened several times, yes, in the last 120 years. 1940 to 1965, the warming sort of, you know, petered out and then took off. Likewise, 1890 to 1920. As we all know, the system is dynamic. It just is not going to go in a static way, monotonically rising. So I'm not sure why that argument is not brought up. You know, this hiatus is nothing new. We have seen it, and the system has recovered and the CO2 overwhelmed.
Yeah, and I think Kevin Trenberth and others did bring that up. This is a nonlinear system. It's subject to fits and starts. But I think at the public level, it looked like sophistry. It wasn't so persuasive. The other thing that's worth saying is the last hiatus in the 40s through 70s, the IPCC have a sort of medium confidence result that it was probably due to the industrialization of North America and Europe post-Second World War, and it stopped when we learned how to control sulfur dioxide emissions from power plants, acid rain problem. But that's not 100% supported.
One quick question. I want to add another obituary to what you presented, and Peter Waltham's. There's another strange thing happening in the extratropical oceans. You know, the storm track clouds is what keeps the whole extratropics as cold as it is now. And we published a paper 2 years ago. These storm track clouds are retreating further, letting in more sunlight reach the oceans. So there's one more thing happening in addition to the sea ice retreating.
At this conference, we've heard of three or four things that are occurring during the hiatus that suggest that we're in a different metastable state of the climate. We heard from Ralph Keeling about the oxygen anomaly. The evidence of the North Atlantic subduction comes. There was a major change in the salinity of the North Atlantic Ocean beginning with the hiatus. I didn't indicate this, but along with the La Nina state, there's a basic state of the mid-latitude climate heat transport system, which is leading to multiple strong storms in the eastern United States and drought in the western. And this is a La Nina phenomenon that's just been persistent for long. So there's three or four indicators that suggest that the hiatus is different. And it's not clear that this is the right way to look at it, but it would certainly help if people would sort things out by looking at the climate in phases, the growth phase up to the hiatus, and then separate out the hiatus and see if we see a contrasting set of diagnostics for the climate. I'm violating my own rules here, but Roald, go ahead.
Your wife's going to get after you.
we are going to set a new goal for diplomats, I think it's also very important to redefine the notion of tipping point. Because in the minds of general public, tipping point kind of, you know, has some traction compared to particular people. You know? Yeah. So in what's happening in Russia, for example, public reacted immediately to the fact, I think that it came a couple of years ago, that Russian bear stopped hibernating. And you can see it from the behavior of Mr. Putin.
I think with that one, we have a wonderful closing remark, and we should all go to lunch and keep on discussing this. This will come up, this topic will come up later, and we can have more time to discuss it.